Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's?
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line.
Snake bite. Snake bite. I got that snake bite. Oh, look. Well, I should have known something was going on when I saw Rufus running down the road. His eyes were burning, his head on fire.
Welcome to another edition of The Riff Raff. My guest today is Mr. Zachary Richard. Zachary is a songwriter, performer, poet, activist. He's kind of like a Cajun Renaissance man who's done it all. He's never ceased promoting, educating others about the French identity of South Louisiana and his Cajun heritage, which makes it really special for me. Beginning his career in the early 1970s, he took off for France, started a band, went to New York, recorded records. He's now amassed 25 records, multiple Grammy nominations. He's written children's books, poetry. He's got numerous documentaries. He's a pretty amazing guy. He's also employed some great guitar players, among them Sonny Landreth and Bill Dylan. We'll talk about both of those guys. We'll discuss songwriting, guitars. We'll play some songs. It's a Sunday morning, beautiful, and we're just sitting in the front parlor of my house drinking green tea and talking about music. Always loved Zachary's music and gotten to work with him a lot. Hadn't seen him in a while, so this was a nice surprise. Thanks again for listening. I've been getting a lot of great comments. Once again, I'll just say please leave me a nice review on iTunes if you like, or comment. It really helps move this thing up. It's been moving up, actually, in the charts. And it inspires me to make more. I'm just getting off tour here back in New York from this Hall & Oates summer tour and trying to crank these things out. They take a lot of work to edit, so I really appreciate you listening. I'm sitting in my house in New Orleans with my good friend Zachary Richard. Zachary, thanks for coming over on a Sunday morning.
It's always a pleasure, man. You know, come over here and have some matcha and some Japanese matcha sweets. Life in New Orleans.
Man, I was thrilled to hear from you the other day, and I spent yesterday in the studio with you recording on your new record. It was great to... It's been a while since we actually hung out, so...
Thanks for coming. It was... always, as always, a pleasure to hear you play, man, you know. And we were able to survive a session with David Torkanowski.
So. Yeah, it's not the first time. I kind of know how to survive those now. Been through a bunch of them. But, you know, for the listeners, Zachary, I'll have a lot of your discography and history and stuff posted. But Zachary, I guess we first got together probably close to 10 years ago, maybe. I remember getting a call, and I played Festival de Acadienne with you in Lafayette.
Well, that was, again, thanks to David, you know. So yeah. I said, man, I said, I need a guitar player. He said, well, you got to call Shane. He's the cat, you know. So he was right.
Yeah, well, and I remember that gig, man. It was a lot of fun. It was outside. It was at night. And, you know, my dad was a big fan of yours. I remember him being at the gig, you know, him and my mom, and they loved it. But ever since then, let's see, after that, we played numerous gigs, man. We did Montreal Jazz Festival. We did stuff in France.
Well, the 2009 Jazz Festival is was recorded for DVD.
That's right.
As you recall. So there was Paul Picard, Yolanda Robinson, the infamous David Torkanowski. It's the third time I say his name in this.
Don't worry, I'll edit all these out. I won't give him this much airtime.
Yeah, that was, you know, that was an amazing rhythm section and a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. You know. Well, this is a unique episode for me because, number one, this is the first one I've ever done sitting at my house in New Orleans, which is really special. Mm-hmm. And also because, you know, it's more of a, I've had some Louisiana artists on, but you're definitely the most probably direct as far as, you know, just our ancestry we share. You know, a lot of people don't realize the Cajun ancestry, the Terrier, you know, right. Richard. We were the original, a lot of the original exile, the names that were.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
And I know that's a big part of your music, and we're going to talk about all of that because I want people to understand where you come from. That really brings it close to home, you know, in that respect, too.
It's a root that continues to nourish me and surprise me, you know, and I just did a documentary that, and its English version is called Cajun Heart, and basically I went to all of the places that our ancestors had occupied, starting at Port Royal in Nova Scotia, into Grand Pré, Beaubassin, Île Georges, which was the place that interned the Acadians during the exile, before they ultimately wound up coming to Louisiana. And I'm just kind of amazed that anybody even cares. I mean, it's been 250 years, and Cajun culture has been assimilated and denigrated and ridiculed for most of the time that we've been in Louisiana, in spite of which there's this real resonance with every generation kind of redefines its relationship to the tradition and to the culture. The music is very popular. The language is very threatened by assimilation, but ultimately it's still here. And somehow this tradition, this culture maintains itself. You know, Barry Onsley, my neighbor in Lafayette, he's got the best Cajun metaphor about it. He says every time they're about to close the casket on the cadaver of Cajun culture, the body sits up and asks for a beer.
Wow. Perfectly phrased.
But it's something that I think, you know, I don't know if it's the same for Jewish people or black people, or the notion of some of a diaspora coming from someplace, you know, but it's, I think in a lot of ways when you're deprived of that heritage, and we were, if you don't count the Indians, we were the victims of the largest ethnic cleansing in the history of North America. Mm-hmm. And that story continues to resonate. When you find out what happened to our ancestors, you can't help but be pissed off about it. But it's not really about anger for me. It's really about the positive aspects of tenacity and hope and courage and all of these things that our ancestors were able to transmit to us, the values that allowed them to go through all those difficulties and to still maintain their sense of humor, because Cajun people are known to be, you know, it's like the Richard Thériault jokes.
Maybe we should start those instead of Boudreaux Thibodeau. Richard Thériault jokes. Yeah, those would be a little more
sophisticated.
Yeah, a little more introspective and, yeah, dark, probably.
Clubhouse gathering.
But you know, that lineage of the Cajuns and where it brings us today, I mean, I got to be honest with you. When I was a kid growing up, I never knew that last names. I thought names that weren't in the phone book, you know, our phone book, which were all French last names, All those names were strange, you know. I never thought the names in the phone book, all the French names, I could pronounce those like no problem, you know. You don't think about that stuff when you're a kid. Hearing my dad listen to Cajun music every weekend in the garage while he's working on stuff with the radio blaring, you know, all this Cajun music collection. He would take me to Festival d'Acadia when I was a kid, you know, try to get me to play Cajun fiddle. You're trying to do that to a 13-year-old kid who's in the Eddie Van Halen, you know what I mean? And I at some point, you know, in working with you, I kind of felt a little of the guilt, like, man, I should have learned French.
I don't think it's about guilt, Shane. You know, it's really about, you know, the positive aspects of it, you know, because, and that's the key. It has to be attractive. You know, you can't impose culture. I mean, the kids today, there's a whole new generation of young Cajun musicians, the Lost Bayou Ramblers and the Pine Leaf Boys and the Cedric Benoits, and they're all redefining the tradition because they're attracted to it, not because they had to do it. And that's the whole key. It has to be attractive, you know. And there's aspects of the culture which are, even for a kid that grew up playing Eddie Van Halen, attractive, you know. And that's what is just surprising to me, is that in spite of the fact that it's been 250 years that our families have been in Louisiana, in spite of the fact that in that entire period we have been subject to assimilation, which was at the beginning of the 20th century very violently practiced on children. I mean, your grandparents certainly, and maybe your dad even, were punished when they were speaking. I mean, physically beaten when they were speaking French
exactly
in school.
Exactly right. I remember being a little kid, and I remember being in the 70s, you know, early 80s. My grandparents, on my father's side, that's all they spoke in front of us was French when they didn't want us to understand.
Right.
My dad, I remember vividly. I mean, you remember my dad, he could speak French. My grandfather, my mom's dad, he's still alive, speaks French. Right. I remember when he drove me to school in Los Angeles to start music school, there was a guy named Jean-Pierre from Paris, and my grandfather went right up to him, "Como ça va?" started talking, and I was just amazed that I had heard my other set of grandparents speak French, but not this one.
Right.
And they carried on a conversation like 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And a couple weeks later, when I ran into Jean-Pierre in class, we had started class, I asked him, "Could you understand my father, my grandfather?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, perfectly. But it was kind of Shakespeare kind of," which I thought was amazing. That's when it really hit. I think sometimes being out of it, you have to get out to really see what you have inside, you know, and appreciate it.
You know, the language is a fundamental aspect of a culture because it not only is a method of communication, but it's also an identity marker, you know. But French is still holding on in Louisiana, and because of education now in the schools, there's reason to believe that new generations will be able to converse fluently in French. So that's my advice to you. Go to school and learn how to talk French. I can help you with that.
I remember my grandmother, who's no longer alive, they got punished if they spoke French in school.
Yeah,
you know, that would have been probably early 1930s, maybe late 1920s.
Right. Yeah. So what do you're a kid, you go to school, how does that make you feel when your maternal language, the only language that you can speak, it has social consequences. Mm-hmm. So you're humiliated at best and beaten at worst. And your parents cannot speak that language. So how do they feel? You know, because I'm certain that my grandparents were delighted that their children, my parents, were able to get an education.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't really know how that made them feel, the fact that it was in a foreign language that they could not speak. So, you know, there's a lot of ambivalence. I'd written a song called No French No More, you might remember.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that, actually. It's on my list. Yeah.
Thank you.
your job just like my papa planned. Wear a suit and dirt never touch my hands. But I still see the look.
But you know, I don't think there's any point in like casting ourselves in as victims. You know, that's what, just what happened.
Yeah.
And what we can do now is just to celebrate our heritage and to transmit that to the future generations, mm-hmm. and to share that with anybody that's interested, whether they're Cajun or not. You know, because mm-hmm. the story is powerful.
Yeah.
And it's a very important aspect of American history that people really don't know about. So that's what, you know, that's what we're here to do.
Well, speaking of history, I want the listeners to know too, you went to Tulane, right? And you majored in history, right?
Yeah, but don't hold that against me.
No, I think it's worth bringing up because you got your degree, and then you that's when you decided you wanted to do something with music besides the traditional route of Cajun music. Even I don't know if you even had that in your head at that point, but you mm-hmm. left and you had this idea that you wanted to sort of push forward.
I don't know how this was like, I graduated, quote unquote, in 1972. And by that time my hair was down to my butt, and all I wanted to do was to play guitar. And, you know, I considered myself to be a folk singer and not mm-hmm. a wannabe lawyer, doctor, Indian chief, which was what my, you know, I had been programmed to do. So, you know, I got through college by chance or by accident. That was really not the focus of my life. I'd started writing songs in 1970, and that's really all I wanted to do was play my guitar and write songs.
No brazo wall, Marcia Dominique. Voyage fini. On arrive à Sabine. Retiens tes larmes, ça me casserait le cœur. Me quitter comme ça, c'est déjà si dur.
Well, let's talk about music for a second. So I know Bob Dylan was probably an influence on you, right?
Of course. You know, I mean, it's like... it's funny because it was all Canadians, you know, or people like Bob Dylan lives, you know, I mean, he's from Minnesota, yeah, which is from
right
people
there.
In Louisiana. That's Canada anyway.
Yeah,
so
right.
It's like, you know, there was especially Neil Young, uh-huh. Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen. All the singer-songwriters.
Robbie Roberts.
Of course. And I was the last, people don't know this, well, some people do, but, you know, there are not many of them. I was the last artist assigned to Elektra. Before the merger, before WEA. So I was, you know, Tim Buckley, Judy Collins, they were on the label. And then David Geffen came in and basically just, you know, fired all my people. And I was in the middle of making a record, which never came out, or it came out 28 years later, which is weird. But anyway, I got lost in a vault.
What's the name of that record?
Well, it's called High Time, and I recorded it. We recorded it at the record plant, Studio B. And I remember because the Allman Brothers were in A at the time. It was just like, you know, and I didn't know who they were, but I found out later. Steve Gadd was on the session, Johnny Scholl, Johnny Sigler. I mean, it was like the creme de la creme of New York mm-hmm. session players. And Robert Zachary was the producer. We made the record, and then Geffen took over the record company, and basically I wasn't in his stable, so I was just a problem, basically.
Yeah.
And I was 20 years old, and I didn't give a shit, so I went to the vice president, and I said, man, you guys can... And I'd been ill-advised. I had a lawyer who told me that he could get me a deal with Atlantic in like 10 minutes, and so I went to Elektra, and I gave him the finger and said, you know, you guys can shove it. And they were like... probably delighted because it was like I was just a problem for them. They didn't know what to do with me.
Come on along, we take the ferry boat down to Broville. Come on along and we sit upon the bayou dash. Sit on the oak stump and sip on the clear, clean moonshine. Feeling so very fine. Yeah, boy, your man.
And then You know, I was like, you know, then I realized what I'd done. I was out on the street. I didn't have a record company, but I was only like 20, 21 years old.
Yeah, man.
But
all the time in the world.
I got the accordion because the record, they'd give me $2,500 in advance on the record deal. And that was when my father realized that it was okay to be a musician because I'd made $2,500, you know? And I
sort of validated something.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's like I was making money. So he got into the program, and he actually financed my first record a couple of years later.
Hmm.
But the Cajun part was, I mean, it wasn't Eddie Van Halen, but it was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and the Byrds and Simon and Garfunkel. That's what I was listening to coming up. I knew that there was this thing called Cajun music, but I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't interested in it. There was nobody that I knew played it. I knew that it existed because my grandmother, Passepartout, on Sundays, she would have the KLFY broadcast on. So, you know, and it was kind of the soundtrack to my childhood that way, to my Sundays at Mongon's house. But I didn't really have any interest in Cajun music at all until I got the record deal. And then there was this kind of back to the roots thing going on in America at the time. Willie Nelson was really popular. Sleep at the Wheel was playing at Jay's Lounge in Kankton. So there was all this kind of back to the roots kind of vibe going on. And the Cajun thing was in my wheelhouse. I mean, it was our identity. And I didn't know anything about it. So I bought the accordion. I had $400. I went to see Mark Savoy, and there was this beautiful rosewood accordion, which I lost last year in a flood. But anyway, and he refused to sell it to me. He said, I guess he wanted me to prove
you're worthy of the sword.
Right. So he, you know, he said, can I buy that? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, yeah. So I came back like, you know, enough times and pestered him finally. So he sold me the thing. And then I just sat there with the Ira Lejeune record in a turntable and then just lifted the record arm and tried to cop the lick and, you know, just lick by lick. Finally, after about 6 months, I could play the song.
What was the song?
It was J'ai passé devant ta porte, a traditional waltz. And I took it to my grandmother and played it for her. And she was delighted, you know. And I said, you know, I had the record company and I was going to New York. I had going to make this record. And I had spent the last 6 months on Orange Street. I lived in North Lafayette on Orange Street, right around the corner from Magnolia, where Clifton Chenier lived. And, you know, that was just, I used to tell people that I moved there because of Cliff, but that's not true. I moved there because it was a cheap house to rent. And it just happened around the corner from Clifton Chenier.
Little benefit, side benefit to it.
Yep. So then, you know, I started playing Cajun music and, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Could we sidestep a second? I'm wondering if you could maybe play some on the accordion.
Don't consider myself to be an accordion.
No, just
player.
A couple little licks, you know, because
I do one thing. I'm sort of like, I'm a harmonica player too, because I did the same thing with the blues harp, you know. But it was a little Walter and James Cotton and those cats that I was listening to. But there's so many cats that play.
So this is an accordion that my dad never got to play, unfortunately, and so I've kind of inherited it back. But you had looked at it once, and Joel Sonia looked at it once, and I had both of you over here playing at a different time, and I thought, man, I got like two of the badass Louisiana musicians playing this thing. So
that's a good accordion, you know.
Oh, oh, mama, yeah, pour moi. Sauvez mon âme. Flamme d'en bas, yeah, pour moi, sauvez mon âme, je suis condamné.
Yeah, it's hard to play in an acoustic setting because of the there's nothing on the but the the one and the four
yeah.
on the left side. So when you get to the five,
yeah, it's a four. It implies the four chord over that. Yeah, yeah. I know. Yeah, I think it needs a little work. That I remember you telling me it was the action or whatever it's called on accordions a little higher. But
it sounds
great in here, man. With these high ceilings, I love the sound of it. I want to talk, since I do have a lot of listeners that are guitar players, you know, I mean, you have a unique association with a couple of guitar players, most notably Sonny Landreth,
right,
who played in your band. Now, was that Zach Attack? Was Sonny and Zach Attack?
Let's see. Sonny, you know, for the people who don't know the amazing story of Sonny Landreth, Sonny Landreth grew up in northern Mississippi, around Clarksville, I believe, in, you know, like in the Delta. So I don't know what that had to do with it. But his family moved to Lafayette, and Sonny started playing electric guitar when he was like 10 years old. And he became, according to Eric Clapton, probably the best slide player of modern times.
You know, he's my favorite. He's Sonny's, definitely the most unique.
Sonny's mm-hmm. just an amazing, amazing talent. And Sonny played with Cliff. He was the first white guy to play in Clifton's band. And then he left Cliff, and he was with me for about 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. In the late 80s. Late 70s, I'm thinking. Late 70s, early 80s, you know?
Yeah.
And then he went on to form his own band, and he hadn't looked back since.
And there's a live record. I had it. Is it Live in Montreal?
Right, yeah. Right, right.
Also, I remember playing with you in, maybe it was Toronto or someplace, and this guy comes up with these little John Lennon glasses on.
Oh, yeah.
We start talking, and he goes, you know, he complimenting on my guitar playing, and he said, yeah, I'm a friend of Zachary's, I'm Bill Dylan. I go, wow, Bill Dylan.
Right.
For those of you that don't know, he was, for a while, he was in the stable of Daniel Lanois' musicians when he had his sort of residency in New Orleans, I guess, at that point.
Well, that was actually before, because they both came from Ontario. And, you know, Daniel Lanois has been credited with creating this entire landscape of sound, which is influenced by Brian Eno to a great extent. Mm-hmm. But the untold story, and, Dan might not agree with me, but a lot of that had to do with Bill Dylan, because Bill and Daniel were recording together in mm-hmm. in Toronto at the beginning. And I don't know exactly when I found out about Bill Dylan, but when I did, man, it's just like, whoa, you know. And he was on my 1996 recording called Caponragé, which is mm-hmm. the most successful record that I've ever done. And I think in large part to two guitar players, Bill Dylan, who was the king of atmosphere, you know. I remember going to get him at the airport, and it was just like, you know, here was this skinny dude with these little Beatle glasses and Beatle boots and a Beatle hat, dragging literally a duffel bag full of pedals. You know, I mean, it was just like he was literally dragging it off the plane. And when we laid it all out, it like took, it would probably take up half this living room. His pedal board was, you know, it was about 20 feet square.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, but Bill's like an amazing cat to work with, because he's like, he considers himself to be a painter. You know, at least that's what he says. You know, he says he's always dealing in colors and atmosphere as opposed to sound. And it's true in a way, because I mean, it's all about washes, and he's such an incredible he has such finesse for sound.
Yeah.
And the guitargan, which is like an instrument that only he can play. Really, I bought one because of him. I found one in a pawn shop in Toronto, and it's like, I don't know if you know, your listeners know what a guitargan is, but check it out. It's this cross between an organ and a guitar, and it's got sensors in the fretboard, which is actually what emits the sound. You don't strum the thing. It doesn't have any pickups. It's got these sensors on the frets that generate sound some kind of way. And it's got, I opened it up one time, it's got about 25 miles of cable inside the axe. Anyway, and Bill perfected the style of that thing, which is something that I think he's been really the only person in
history. Is there a particular track or tracks that you remember off your record that maybe that's on, or any Bill Dylan stuff that's
well, you know, that album Cap Enragé, which was done in 1996, there's something called the Nord Canadien, which comes to mind, which is an atmospheric mm-hmm. piece about mm-hmm. The Great White North.
La solitude et l'oubli dans son seul auto les brandons de mon feu.
All of these just incredible sounds, and his effects and his notion of effects and the use of delay and chorusing and all that, you know, he's really a master at, he's a one of a kind, and he's still living and working in Ontario, incredible player, and I haven't seen him in a while, but I know he's still alive and kicking and doing well, so, you know. If you're listening in, Bill, keep it up.
yeah. He was a nice cat. I remember exchanging contact information.
Coffee, man. It was like, he's like espresso addict, you know. He'd have a little stand. When he was working here in New Orleans, he had driven down. He was like a car freak, too. He'd driven down in an XKE Jaguar.
Wow.
And he would sit at, they had made him this little stand. It was like a mic stand with a tray for his coffee. And you just like, keep espressos
one
coming.
After
he
another.
Must have drank, you know, 20 espressos in a session. You just keep it, you know. So intense dude, but a beautiful player, really a sweet man. Freddie Coella. I don't know if you want to talk about Freddie, but Freddie was with us for a while. I'm just, you know, going through my inventory of incredible guitar players. You know, Freddie, I met in France, and I actually was responsible for him coming over to the United States. He and a drummer and a bass player lived in a trailer that I had rented and put on my property in Scott, and they were just sort of like French rhythm section illegal aliens. So, you know, and he went on to have an amazing career. He was with Dylan for many years, and he's still active in Los Angeles, playing a lot with French artists because he's from Strasbourg, he's from Alsace-Lorraine. Incredible player. Anyway, you know, I've had the great fortune of playing with such amazing musicians, you know. So, I mean, you included in that number. And I love, you know, I want to be a guitar player myself. So, you know, I appreciate it particularly.
Coming up the way you did, kind of rediscovering Cajun music, but you took it a different direction. You didn't sort of reinvent, you know, Jolet Blanc or Appaloosa Sostan or something like that. You put these political and this passion, the lyrics, into the traditional conduit of like the Cajun music instrumentation. I mean, did you meet any like resistance with that? Like, when was your first debut? And like, when you hit, did people go, "What is this? This isn't Cajun music"?
When I put my first record out, I remember I wasn't there to see this, but I was told that Mark Savoy, who's kind of the doyen, the master of contemporary Cajun recording, he threw my album, it was an LP, he threw it across his record shop and said, "This is not Cajun, this is not country, this is not rock, this is bullshit."
He should have sold you the accordion.
He did, you know? Yeah, it was too late. You know, he'd already sold it to me, so maybe he regrets it. But it's like, you know, I'm a, I'm a folk singer. I'm a songwriter. That's what I am. Yeah. But I play accordion on occasion, or have done, and my name is pronounced funny, so people go, oh, that must be Cajun music, which I guess in a way it is, in as much as I'm part of the tradition. But my real identity as a songwriter is in the American tradition. You know, those influences that we mentioned, Dylan and Neil Young and Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen, etc., etc., those are the people that have influenced me the most. I also write in French, and I've had the good fortune to be able to develop my songwriting as a French-speaking North American songwriter. So, you know, is it Cajun music? Strictly speaking, no. You know, but it gets confusing because, you know, I pay homage to the tradition. But in just in terms of style, I've probably written, that I know of, three songs in the tradition that come to mind, you know, out of, I don't know, 300. So it's not the focus of my, it's not the focus of my songwriting, but it's an important aspect of my life and of my identity. But what I try to do is to write songs, regardless of what language that they're in, that will communicate to people and that I'll be able to inspire and touch and entertain and to make reflect and to influence eventually people who appreciate my songs.
Hmm. C'est pas la peine de faire comme si tout est foutu, tout est pourri. La vie est dure, y a pas d'espoir.
Guitar that you're playing, Zach, is my 1952 Gibson J45, which has an interesting story because I sort of had to woo this guitar to get it. I found it, and it was across the lake in Mandeville, Louisiana, and you went with me on a Sunday morning to look at this guitar.
Yeah, and the guy was like, it was a, you know, house in suburbia, and the guy was kind of like not really all that friendly.
It was weird. Yeah, he didn't really want to sell it, what happened. But you see that big nick, that big pretty ding?
Yep.
I took that guitar out of a case on the way to a session one day in a hurry, and bam. I mean, it was mint condition up till then, but and that one hurt, man.
Yeah, well, I got a 57.
Yeah.
I don't know if you remember that guitar.
Yeah, but, I remember it.
It's like first cousin. I mean, just J45... Early 50s J45s is like, man, if I was on a desert island with one thing, it would be a 1950s J45.
It's the perfect, I've said this in a guitar magazine one, it's the perfect EQ curve for recording. The Martin sometimes can be a little boomier, you know, the D28s, but the J45, it's something about it. It's fat, and it'll still sit in a mix, and it won't be too boomy, you know.
And it's a pretty guitar, too, man. You know, it's like, you know, the Martins are known for their clear finishes, but you know, this sunburst is just, you know, so classy.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks,
it still sounds,
it's pretty. Could we play maybe a little bit of Lac Bijou?
If I can
sort of remember that. I would listen to it last night. It was such a beautiful song. You want to say what it's about real quick? And
songs for me, Shane, are, you know, they're like a mystery. I don't really, I'm not a very disciplined songwriter. I just kind of walk down the street and something just happens, you know. And this song, it was originally called Lac Begno, which is, if you go to the Atchafalaya Basin at Henderson, there's a cut that'll take you back, way in the back. And if you're not really careful, you could get lost back there. But there's a place called Lac Begno. So I'd written a song called Lac Begno, and I put it in a drawer. And it just stayed there for, I don't know, a long time. Bijou is the French word for jewel. And that, it went from Lac Begno to Lac Bijou. And it's a story of purple martins, you know, those beautiful birds that come back. And it's a story of love and faithfulness. And so these two birds keep coming back and coming back, but one year there's only one of them. And so it's a song, it's a little bit of a nostalgic bird watching piece.
I love it.
Dans le bois de Takapo, où la rivière joint la levée, planté dans l'once est un vieux chêne vert au bord du lac du jour. Dans son feuillage où les branches vont le gros. Les hirondelles reviennent chaque printemps. Ils se réfugient dans ce chêne vert au bord du lac du jour. Tantalons mes bras, tiens-moi serré encore. Reste avec moi en bas le chêne vert au bord du lac du jour. C'était l'année dans ses grandes ailes. La première fois je les ai vus. Un grand monsieur, noir comme la nuit, sa demoiselle avec lui. Il revenait quand l'hiver était fini. Je les appelais Pierre et Marie. Un grand monsieur, noir comme la nuit, sa demoiselle avec lui. Tantalons mes bras, tiens-moi serré encore. Reste avec moi en bas le chêne vert au bord du lac du jour. Pendant le carême, ce dernier mois d'avril, je l'ai vu une dernière fois. Un oiseau seul posé sur sa branche au bord du lac du jour. Il revenait quand l'hiver était fini, guettant du matin au soir jusqu'au dimanche qu'il est parti aussi du bord du lac du jour. Tantalons mes bras, tiens-moi serré encore. Reste avec moi en bas de chêne vert au bord du lac du jour. Reste avec moi en bas le chêne vert au bord du lac du jour.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to play that after however long it was. It's been
Some songs like age well, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the shit that I wrote, I got that's not But this one's kind of. I guess that's what makes it a classic. You know?
Yeah, yeah, it's a beautiful tune. To write something that you're so passionate about, something like No French No More, how does it feel to perform in front of a large crowd to know your messages? You know, how's that feel when it resonates with that many people? Is there, because I felt it playing with you. I remember thinking, you know, I didn't even think about that subject before it came up, you know, and it's such a strong thing.
Well, there's two things, you know, and I don't. I've never attempted to deliver a message in a song.
Hmm.
And maybe some people do, but I have. I don't know if it's respect, but I'm a little bit more awed by the magic of the experience. I've never sat down to say, "Oh, today I'm going to write a song about this," or "Today I'm going to write a song about that." I've always just kind of jammed, and you know, my instrument of choice is an acoustic guitar. So you just sit there, and you know, I know three chords basically. So I'll just, you know, I'll play them, and I'll just go blah 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 blah. And every once in a while, something will come out of that, you know, just a little. Or I'll hear a piece of melody. Sometimes I even dream melodies. So that's like the key that opens a door, and then you just go down the hallway and see what you can find. Eventually, that'll transform itself. That blah, blah becomes a word. And it's like I'm very Jungian, as in Carl Jung. So there's this energy field, this universal super consciousness that everybody is part of. And, you know, the work of the artist is to somehow open up the passageway into that and allow that to come into the conscious world and to use those experiences to create art, no matter what form that happens to take. And that's what happens to me. And, you know, so I'll go, well, today I'm going to write write a song about shooting the guy with the weed eater.
that would be a good one. I'm about to do that.
No, I've never consciously decided to write about anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but I'm a human being and I have feelings and a head and a heart. So there's things that are part of my life, like the natural environment of Louisiana. You know, you think about Sunset on Louisiana. I never sat down and go, oh, I'm going to write a song about protecting the Gulf Coast of Louisiana. I just started to write a song, and it just seemed that was a good thing to write about because it was something that I felt strongly.
Yeah.
And I could communicate well, or at least as well as I can. And that's what it's all about to me. So these songs, and I, you know, especially in French, the French language stuff, because there are songs, Réveil comes to mind, No French No More, which is actually bilingual. And there are other tunes which are more inspired by the natural environment. But never have I ever sat down to deliberately write about something that could be considered to be propaganda. I've never said, well, today I'm going to write a song about, you know, the oil spill because it's important that we save the coast. It's just this, I get inspired to write a song and it just leads to that place because that's who I am and that's part of my life, which is the way it should be because I refuse categorically to subject my songwriting to propaganda, even though I feel really strongly about a lot of things. I think it would be a sacrilege to take the magic and the mystery of the song and to put it to the service of any cause, no matter what that cause is, no matter how good the cause is, no matter how strongly I feel about it. But there are songs like No French or Réveil or Le Fou, which speaks about the oil spill in 2010, which have social resonance. And I'm very proud of that, in spite of the fact that I don't really have a direct involvement in the... It's not as though it's a deliberate effort on my part to influence the way people think or the way they feel about things. But it's just, well, you know the term lanyap.
Yeah.
That to me is the lanyap of some of my songs, because instead of just talking about crawfish and filet gumbo or a broken heart, sometimes I sing about things of social consequence, which I would be very proud to believe would have a positive impact on the way that people think or the way they feel about certain things, like the natural environment, like the French language in Louisiana, like the state of culture in North America, etc. But it's not a deliberate effort on my part. So when it happens, it's really lanyap. It's like the song is giving back to me.
A little extra is for those of you that don't know what lanyap means. It means something a little extra. That's interesting. I actually didn't even know that. I didn't realize it wasn't an attempt to. Not that it sounds contrived or anything, you know.
But if it was, I think it would sound contrived. If, you know, you sat down and say, well, today I'm going to save the planet.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to write a song
be like
about
We Are the World or something. Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I just can't do that. I'm not a disciplined songwriter. I know songwriters that, I mean, I did that too. You probably have, I'm sure, done the, you know, the 11, 12, 1 o'clock Nashville thing.
Yeah.
You just go from office to office, sit there with somebody, and you try to do something. And, you know, something happened. I did that for a while. And, you know, I wrote songs with other people like that, but I've never recorded them. And I don't think any of them ever were recorded because I was never really inspired.
No, it's more of a factory approach, a rubber stamp approach. Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm just be walking in the airport and I'll hear something and I can't wait to get back to the guitar when I can, like, actually. And then what it's about kind of happens later, and what language it is that I don't even choose that. I don't choose what, because I write in two languages, and I've written probably as many songs in both languages. Which language do I pick? I don't pick. It's the sound of that kind of
dictates.
Nebulous word that is already in a language. So when I hear a sound, I can tell from the diphthong whether it's in French or in English. So I know right away what language the song has decided that it wants to be in. So it's a much more natural and organic and totally lazy process for me. You know, it's like I don't really
I don't consider it lazy. I mean, all my favorite singer-songwriters that I've ever had the pleasure to work with, they all have described a similar process. They don't think about that stuff. They just kind of happens. They hear it in their head and they develop it.
Yeah.
And it's not something they sit down like I'm going to bake a chocolate cake today. No. It's just you think about an idea and you develop it.
Married a girl from Portia Bridge, raised a family of Cajun kids. Nobody did no better than we did, but things can always change. My papa's been a trapper living hand to mouth. When I made shop for him, I had it all figured out. I thank God each and every day when the industry comes. Sunset on Louisiana, sun going down on my promised land. I've given you everything I can.
Was that tune Someday?
Oh, sure.
Remember that tune? Yeah, I had to change the tuning heads on that thing before they disintegrate.
Someday I'll be going home. Someday I'm going on. Don't you know I got a long way to go. Someday I'll be going on. I'll be riding home a cold black Tennessee street. Riding on a cold black Tennessee street. Eyes burning fire with elegance. I'll be riding on a gold black Tennessee steed. I'll be wearing a gold solid gold. Wearing a gold solid gold. Shining like the sun, a true beauty to behold. Wearing a gold solid gold. Little bridge. Gonna see my mama and my papa. Brothers and my sister too, yeah. Don't you know I know I got a long way to go. Someday I'll be going home.
Born where the water tastes like wine. Born where the water tastes like wine. I'm gonna get drunk every morning. I wanna feel good all the time. Born where the water tastes like wine. Gonna see my mama and my papa, brothers and my sister too, yeah, yeah. Don't you know, no, I got a long way to go. Someday I'll be going home. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, Zachary, thank you, man, for doing this.
My pleasure, Shane. Always. You know, it's always fun to play. So
absolutely. I hope it's not...
Tea and Japanese cakes. I'll come over anytime.
And there's more. All right. Thanks for listening. All right. There you have it, Mr. Zachary Richard. I hope you enjoyed that one. That was a really special one. If you'd like to hear more of these with guests such as Mike Stern, John Scofield, Dweezil Zappa, Warren DeMartini from Rat, and we really run the gamut here. I'm going to keep interviewing friends until I run out. Go to my website, shaneterrio.com. Click on podcasts. They're all there. iTunes, they're all there. And I have some more surprises in store, hopefully in the next few months, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.